What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Devi. I've been following her for a while on Instagram and all the socials, really, and just have like really appreciated her voice. One of the things I have checked out of hers is her podcast called Where Do We Go From Here, which is just sort of exploring sexual ethics for Christians. And I just think like this is a really important thing that we need to be doing. There's so much of that has not been talked about or kind of pushed to the side. And as a church, I think we failed to deal with that and really like equip people to talk about sexuality and handle sexual ethics. And so I think there's a lot of great stuff there. Devi's an awesome writer, an awesome follow. And in this episode, we get into so many things about vocation, but like tracing Devi's life of vocation and how she was shaped by her family culture. We also get into a lot of the idolatry just in the American church, which centers on these purity culture ideas and just the way we present ourselves as this prosperous people, and just breaking down a lot of those things. I think there's a lot of great stuff in this episode. We cover a lot of area, and I think you're really going to love hearing from Devi. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the podcast, what we got going on. I'm also working on a little side project called Bootleg Bible College over on YouTube, which just is just simple ways of explaining things that I think people need to know about Bible and theology. And so go check that out if that's something you're interested in. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Devi. All right. Well, Devi, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and chatting with me. This is super fun to connect.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. So many good conversations. I'm excited to ask you so many questions about your story and all that. So
yes,
let's jump off and just have you just introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Sure. So I'm Devi Abraham. I live in Melbourne, Australia. But I guess my backstory of where I've sort of come from, I was born in Sri Lanka, and my parents, when I was about near 2 years old, decided to become missionaries to the Philippines. So they went to the Philippines via a year and a half in Northwest Arkansas, in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where they raised support and got extra theological training. And I say all of that because I think that's really, when you talk about vocation, that my understanding of vocation was shaped very much by the fact that my parents were in full-time ministry before I was even conceived. Right. So that was the life I was born into, the life that I had my whole life. And so that's kind of where I grew up, Philippines and Arkansas. And then I did 4 years of university. I know, 4 years of university in Arkansas, which is random, in a small Christian university.
You went to college in Arkansas?
In Arkansas, yeah. Okay. Not to the University of Arkansas. I went to a small Christian university in Siloam Springs. And I think the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about my parents is even though they were in full-time ministry, they were also Sri Lankan Tamil. And there's a strong ethic in Sri Lankan Tamil culture that you become a professional something. It was just sort of required. Like my grandmother, my maternal grandmother went to university. My mother graduated top of her class from university. So it's just sort of, it was the norm. And what was expected of women was that you would go to university. I can't even imagine sitting down with my parents then to say, I'm not going to university. I'm going to become a musician. It would not have been okay to have that conversation with them. Yes. And so, but at the same time, I had a really clear sense of, I think, what I was good at, what I was interested in. So I studied journalism and history. And the plan was really to go and become a journalist. But I worked on the university newspaper. I did an internship in Washington, D.C. for a month. But my last year of work on the university paper, I was editor, and it was super, super stressful. And then I was on a student visa in the U.S. In the aftermath of September 11th. And so you had to kind of find a job a month after you graduated, or you had to leave. And I just did not have the energy, the emotional bandwidth to do all of that on my own. And so I had permanent residency in Australia. My dad's whole family lives in Australia, in Melbourne. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to move to Australia so that, you know, when everybody gets that question at the end of university, what are you doing when you graduate? My answer was, Well, I'm moving to Australia, and that would kind of take care of that question. And yeah, so I moved to Australia, worked here, didn't have a job actually for a year. It was very discouraging, difficult process to transition into the job market here. And then I worked as a writer here in a marketing division of a university, of a public university. So did that, then stopped, traveled around the world, met my husband while I was traveling around the world. He was working at the time in Geneva, Switzerland. So we got married in 2010. I moved to Switzerland. Moved to Switzerland. Honestly, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I was kind of like, I just let me get there and then figure it out. Well, 6 weeks after we got married, I got pregnant. So then it was like, well, I guess I'm doing this. So I'm transitioning. A transition to a new country is a big deal, a really, really big deal, especially to a country where you can't speak the local language, even though Geneva is very, very, very multicultural and diverse and full of expats who do not speak French. But so did that, had our first son 2011, and then we moved to Sweden in 2013 when he was two and our second child was 8 weeks old. We're in Sweden. Yeah, it was a lot.
It was a lot.
So 2 years in Sweden. And then we kind of went, right, reevaluate our life. And we decided, I was really struggling. Happy to talk about that more later. Moved back to Australia. I just needed to be somewhere English speaking. And so we've lived here. And I guess through all of that, I've been writing. So in 2010, when we got married, I started a blog. Started just going, I need to start writing again. I don't know how to do this. Okay, I'm cooking every day. I love to cook. I'm going to start a food blog. And just started writing through food, actually. And through that, I think I just found my voice again and then started writing about other things that then, and as you know, the blogging world became the social media world. And so now I do still have a blog, but I do most of my sort of lab, I call it lab writing in Instagram, just to see kind of what's going to stick. And then I freelance write, and I hope to do that more. But then last year, a friend and I started a podcast together. And so that's kind of where I'm at now. That's
cool.
Condensed version.
That's a heck of a story. I have so many questions. We'll get to the podcast. I'm very interested in all that.
Yeah.
But I want to like not neglect questions that I have just about growing up because you know, you're coming from a culture to be an MK, right? Via I assume is pretty conservative evangelical.
Oh, absolutely.
Arkansas, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you sort of, I guess looking back, how do you sort of like put all those pieces together of your growing up and what culture was to you and yeah.
Yeah. I think first of all, as a child, I realized I was just doing it all. You know, I'm not super conscious of how I was doing it, but I was doing it. I'm certain of that. So it's been more as an adult that I've looked back on that. And as an adult who's raising multiracial children in a third culture context for them. So they were born in Switzerland. Their father is a different culture from their mother. Both their father and their mother are immigrants to Australia. So really they're first generation Australians who were not born in Australia. So I think that's really how I've kind of unwound my own experience is through the lens of having to parent them. But that is to say, it was very complicated. And I think I would say the dominant culture in our home was really white American evangelicalism, even though we were in the Philippines and my parents were Sri Lankan. So my parents were, when we were first in Arkansas, it was kind of the end of 83 to 85. So I didn't realize this at all until this year of studying purity culture, that is literally like the seedbed years of the moral majority in the United States. So
were you born in 83?
I was born in 82.
82. Okay. I'm 83. So okay. We're right there.
Yeah. And so I think it was really dominated by purity culture ideas. And I don't know if you feel this way, but it does feel like when you think of American evangelicalism and what it was like to grow up, the purity culture piece was a big, big part of that piece. So my parents were not pro-America in that we ate American food or like pro-American politics in that sense. But it was very much the theology. So my dad was an evangelist, and the way we did things was very much the American kind of discipleship model, you know, Romans Road, you know, those kinds of tracks and that kind of thing. And so there was nothing for me outside of evangelicalism. This was it. Like, it was, you listen to Salty, you listen to Sandy Patty and Twyla Paris. I can still sing all those songs. And that's what it meant to be a Christian, even though it also meant, obviously, like reading your Bible, praying, all of those things. But yeah, I think I definitely grew up with a sense of, you know, I was the oldest child. We need to do the right thing. We need to make our parents look good. Even though my parents didn't actually explicitly say that, I felt it though. It is what was kind of implied, as many, as you know, you have pastors' children of your own, I think.
Correct. And yes. Yeah. And we're both, my wife and I are both oldest kids.
Oh, right. So you get families. It. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. No, I that's interesting. So I grew up in Texas.
Okay.
Actually, Aaron Moon and I like grew up in the same town,
yes.
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but my parents, it was very cultural Christianity, right? So like my parents weren't like faithful church people. So I didn't grow up in like a evangelical subculture, except that I did.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. So my interactions with purity culture didn't happen until I got saved when I was 18, like legit, like found Jesus.
Right.
And then was kind of pushing back on purity culture for younger generations. Like I was doing youth ministry early on in that. And that was like, I kiss skating goodbye.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Which just got, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know,
I was fighting against it pretty early on, even though like I had a purity necklace back in the day.
Yes.
You know?
So, okay. Yeah.
But so when your parents became Christians in Sri Lanka or however that works, was that into like sort of an American evangelical context?
Yeah, no. So not at all. Okay. So they were raised, both of them were raised in Christian homes, but they were raised in, my dad was raised in the Anglican church and my mom was raised in the Methodist church. So Sri Lanka has two dominant ethnic groups. Well, one dominant ethnic group. So it's about 74% Sinhalese, about 15% Tamil. And then a grouping of minorities who are Muslim, Berger, so Portuguese, Dutch, intermarried. Okay. And religiously, how that falls is sort of 74% Sinhalese are Buddhist primarily. The 15% Tamil are primarily Hindu. And then there's a small minority of Christians who are a mix of all of those different religions. Muslims are Muslim, of course. And yeah, but it's a tiny minority. And my parents just happened to be born into that tiny minority. So it's very British. Sri Lanka was colonized by the British for hundreds of years. Okay. So it was more probably a British expression of faith, actually, much not at all American evangelicalism. But then my parents really got radically saved in their teens through Youth for Christ. And that was maybe through a little bit more American, but I still wouldn't say that it was. For them, I would say the expression of their faith was really just, it was Jesus, it was the Bible, it was salvation. The Bible is real. We tell people about Jesus. It was really that simple. But then, like, you have to remember, it's also, Sri Lanka is, without Christianity, it's a very conservative culture. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, yeah, it's a very conservative culture as it relates to men and women and that kind of thing and sexuality and everything else. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I'm like, as somebody who's only lived in America, like I've never even been out of the country. Like, it's so interesting to me, like that cultural, like the variance of culture. Like I've only been in a singular, predominant white culture in America.
You know? Yeah. No, it is really different. And I think to you know, the purpose of your podcast, it informed so much of how I think about work. Because it's interesting, my parents never gave me that idea that Christian work is special or ministry is ministry. Because my dad's thing was always like, if you're a Christian, you're working where you are. Like your work is your ministry. Right. But then we'd go to the US where we were treated very differently because we were missionaries and very much like you're doing the Lord's work. And so even though the explicit teaching, you know, in our home and the ideas that my parents never just encouraged people to join the ministry or become full-time this or full-time that. That wasn't, you know, that wasn't their thing. They worked with people who were in all kinds of different fields. But I think the Christian culture around me definitely elevated and legitimized a certain kind of work. And that was very much pastors, missionaries, people who were suffering for Jesus in a very, and the way, of course, they were suffering is they're paid badly. So that's how they're suffering for Jesus. Right. Never mind that that's not actually, you know, that's not in the Bible, but okay. Yeah,
because, and I've talked to somebody from who grew up in an Indian household.
Yes.
Who was Christian, you know, grew up Christian, but he said very similar things about his parents. And like, that was never a divide. I wonder how much of that has to do with the time period you're talking about specifically, like the church becoming more of an enterprise than it was a community, right? As a way to build sort of this thing, we're building this church and we're going to grow it huge. And, you know, it's this,
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point. I think definitely that could be part of it. And I think my parents were never part of that. That wasn't the idea of our family household. Cause again, they're coming from, I guess, technically you would call them mainline churches in Sri Lanka. Yeah. They're not considered mainline. Right. They're just churches, but they're not coming out of that mentality of you need more numbers, you need more this, you need more, you know, bigger, better. Yeah. That was really an American, those are American ideals, very American ideals that that then get exported everywhere. So you have that now in Australia with Hillsong, obviously kind of took that on board and then became, I mean, Hillsong is probably bigger than a lot of American mega churches, but
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, when you talk, cause like there's a lot about evangelicalism right now, right?
Yes.
And especially our generation, I feel like is very, very much just sort of deconstructing, reconstructing. Yeah. We're just in a process.
Yeah.
We're just
in a process. That's right. Yeah.
but what you talked about your parents and the way that they sort of thought about things was Jesus and the Bible and spreading, you know, sharing the gospel, which
absolutely
that's evangelical and it's like really good distilled form. Like that's the beauty of it, right?
Yeah. And I think I've always had those basics. I think I'm grateful for that. Grateful that every day of my life I woke up and saw my parents reading their Bible. And I think those were the basics. Now, of course, a lot of things got sidelined in the process. Right. A lot of things related to how are we doing, like mental well-being and, you know, just relational, emotional health and all of that stuff. But I think I'm still grateful that for me, when I think about what Christianity actually is, I am able to separate it from kind of the cultural American stuff. And I think for us, Curry, I don't know if you find this, that, you know, as we get into our 30s and 40s, there's a sense of it's ours to take care of. The faith is totally now ours to take care of. And that's part of the reason why we're happy to throw away some things and hold on to some other things. But I think that kind of clarity is really needed to say, okay, what actually is here that is worth holding on to? And I think for me, that is still Bible, Jesus, Holy Spirit, fellowship of believers, whatever that looks like. And the care of the culture around us, to care for our culture instead of kind of making war against it, that because of what God has done, because of the Holy Spirit living in us, I don't need to face my culture in a position of fear. I don't need to do that. I can face it with an attitude of love. And that's what I can do with my vocation. I can use my vocation as a way of actively loving and caring for the world around me, whether or not we affirm the same ideas about God, the Bible, marriage, etc.
Preach, Devi. I love it. That's yes. I just have the like praise hands up there for sure. Yeah. I totally agree with that. I think that's an incredible way. Yeah. There's so much to that. I think that we could talk about. I want to get into a little bit though of sort of your life. What I found interesting in sort of like delving into some of your blog and stuff is there's this idea in your life. And and I'm just, this is an outsider perspective, but you kind of have this like world facing side of yourself where you're a writer, you're a podcaster, you have stuff out in the world, but it feels like there's this compelling side of you that is just about quiet, like at home life, right? That's like where you want to be. And you have all this other stuff where you share ideas, which is awesome. But you talk a lot about motherhood and just being can you just talk about that sort of juxtaposition, I guess?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think as my son likes to tell me, I am the most boring person in the whole world. That's a direct quote, a direct quote. And it is really actually true. Like, I like my life pretty basic. I am an introvert in the classic sense of being an introvert, in that I like spending time alone. But I think, yeah, I found myself when I became a wife and a mom, I found myself at a crossroads of a lot of different conflicting points. So I think one thing I didn't mention in the kind of origin story part at the start is that when I moved to Australia, I had a real sense of like, I knew what I was good at. I knew I wanted to write. There was no question about that in my mind. But I had a fundamental sense of, I feel like my life is broken and I want somebody to fix it. And so I joined a church, and that was very much my attitude when I looked for a church, was I'm going to join this particular church because they believe in discipleship. Discipleship is going to change my life. And in some ways it really did. I mean, that church and those 3 years that I was there really transformed my life in so many different amazing ways. But it was totally steeped in purity culture, ideology, methodology, as it kind of carried over into marriage. And so I became very much, that's where I kind of really got into this idea of married people are at the top of the hierarchy. Married people with kids are at the very top. The more kids you have, the better you are, the more, and it all became like, we had tons of stay-at-home moms in our church. They all looked beautiful on a Sunday morning. Their kids were all kind of in a row. It was a beautiful vision, like a beautiful vision. And I wanted that. Like, I really wanted that idea of like a stable family life. I wanted to be able to create that for myself, for my family. But I couldn't, you can't deny how you're made. So I couldn't deny as well that I was always frustrated by the fact that I wasn't getting to write, no matter how hard I tried to be a good woman, Christian evangelical woman in that sense. So then I get married and I move to, so I marry someone who grew up in a Christian home, but didn't grow up with any of these sort of ideas. So he was in an egalitarian church. He had a female pastor, even though my mother-in-law, you know, worked from home. She was a stay-at-home mom the whole time, so worked from home in that sense. Mm-hmm. But my husband had reported to women. He had women reporting to him in his secular workplace. He did not come from this idea at all of like that women need to be only at home. And then Geneva is full of, so our church in Geneva was full of professional women, and not just professional, women who were like at the top of their field in multinational organizations. So I come into this world, I very quickly have a child, and now I'm like, okay, the only way to have a stable family is if I'm a devoted wife and mom at home. The culture around me, all of my friends are putting their kids into childcare at like 6 months, and Swiss French childcare was like, they get 3-course meals, they get, this is not a joke, like 3-course meals for lunch. They're all sitting down eating their celery salad, their fish with sauce, and their fruit compote for dessert. Like, that is what's happening in these childcare centers. Yes. And the kids are speaking French and, you know, all of that stuff. And then also the sense of the clock is ticking on my own life and what are you doing with yourself? And so I struggled for 5 years probably to figure that out, because the reality was that I was not coping. I couldn't juggle everything. I think that's one of the myths out there for moms, is that you can have a kid, you can have this side hustle, boss babe career, you can do it all, and you can't. Right. I don't believe that you can. So I think my friends who have worked and had kids, the only way they've done it successfully is to just say, I'm going to do some things not as well as other things, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And they've thrived, you know, in that. And I think one thing that I realized from the very beginning is that I'm just not very good at doing multiple things at the same time. I'm not that person. And I was very privileged in that I did not have to work. And I think at the time I took it as a, like, I'm not working. This is my sacrifice. I'm amazing. Why are all these women around me working? Don't they know that these are, you know, all of this stuff. And I was so angry. I spent a lot of the time of my life in Geneva just angry that I was the only one, that I felt like I was the only one in my shoes. It's taken me years to realize, no, you were deeply privileged. That's why you were in that situation. You didn't have to work. That's why you weren't working. There are women who actually have to go back to work after they have children. They don't get the choice that you have. Right. So those were all the kind of Venn diagrams, if you will, that were going on in my life then. And so because of that, I've just had to learn to cultivate a love and appreciation for the life of the home. And I think, you know, it would have been called homemaking at a certain time. I like how Christy Purifoy, she has a book called Placemaker, and she calls it placemaking. And I love that. And I think it's also healed my own MK heart, being able to create a home for my kids in every place that we've been in. Because I think those were the transitions that didn't happen so much for me. It felt like for me as a child, we were just literally plucked out of one thing, landed in another thing. So for me, like being able to manage those transitions for my children in whatever way that I can, I've really enjoyed. And I do love to cook. Like that has never gone away. I'm a terrible, like I don't clean. So my husband actually does a lot of the cleaning in our house. I'm not great at staying on top of that stuff, but I love to cook and I love that experience of sitting down at the table with people. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, I do feel like I live my life kind of on these parallel tracks of life as a mom and a wife, and less a wife actually, life as a mom and life as a writer. But I think, and this is the thing I'd probably go back and tell myself 7 years ago when I had a 2-year-old and a baby, and I just remember weeping in my bed all the time. Like, what is going to happen of this writing thing? What is going to happen with these ideas? I had no idea if I would ever write again. And I think what I would tell her is your life is actually going to change. And even though we've had about, you know, 20 weeks of kids at home doing distance virtual schooling this year, it's still so different. I'm able now to have the time to invest in the work that I wish I had done, you know, 20 years ago when I finished university, to actually give myself back that work as a freelance writer, to actually start thinking about doing journalistic writing again, to say, okay, I can still do this. And that is also an enormous privilege. So I just want to say that, because I think one of the ways we don't realize how much we think about work from the place of our middle class kind of existence, because that's not how it is for most people, because not all work, first of all, can just be, you can just jump right back into it. It just so happens that writing is a field and that you can get back into. You don't have to retrain in that sense. You don't have to, you know, you need to learn a bit about social media, but you, if you're reading, then you can write well. And it's also not, so it's not an industry that is super impacted by just taking long career breaks. But I think, I think it's an incredible privilege to just be like, and now I'm going to start. And that's, you know, that's a gift. It is what it is. I can't do anything about that. I think I really try to keep my mindset about work. And I think this is important too, when I think about writing and women, a lot of the writing space and women in the writing space, particularly in the United States, it expects women to write from a certain place. So you're writing about being a wife, writing about being a mom. Those things are okay. And we don't realize, again, how all of that is often steeped in privilege, that the women who write and publish about these topics, they're able to do it because somebody else is paying for their health insurance and it's their husband's job. Their husband's keeps, you know, and so I feel like that's a conversation that really needs to change with women in the social media world in particular, is just to sort of acknowledge, like, we're privileged. Not all, like, I think there's a lot of people who write from a position of just extreme privilege, and it shows in your writing, because you're telling women to just take personal retreats or go to therapy or do all these things that are, maybe they're good, but they're not available to everybody. And so for me, it's really forced me to become a better writer, to drill down into the deeper things of life, as opposed to looking at these things at the top of what's making my life work. Instead of that, looking at what makes everybody's life work. What are those principles? And those things I feel like are the truest things. It's not sort of therapy and personal retreats. And
No, I really resonate with that. I think that's really good. So I'm the primary caregiver for my three children, right? And as a pastor, I get to stay home and do that, which is pretty cool. But I really resonate with a lot of that, like, struggle and, and the privilege. So there's some, like, mega church pastors that I follow on social or whatever, and they'll be like, you know, this is how you raise men or something, you know, and it's like, we go on a 2-week retreat out into the forest and, like, kill rabbits for food and stuff. And you're like, who can do that? Like, I can't take 2 weeks. Like, it's just mind boggling to me. Like, so when you're giving advice about how somebody should do something, you should think through, like, what is the privilege in the way that I'm being allowed to do these things? Right.
Yeah. It's very interesting hearing your perspective on that as a guy. Because I feel like women really get it. So I didn't realize that men feel like it's going on for them too. There you
go. Yeah, and I think, you know, so like all three of the younger guys at our church yeah. are all stay-at-home dads.
Wow.
And our wives are the main career.
Yeah.
So all the pastors are full-time dads.
Wow. You know?
Yeah. So it's a little, we're a little weird.
That's unusual.
It is very unusual, but it works for
it's
us.
It's great.
Like one, we have a teacher, you know, one of the wives is a teacher. One is a college professor at Wheaton College.
Yeah.
And then my wife does therapy. So, I mean, it works for us since we don't have a building as a church.
Yep.
All three pastors just work from home anyway.
Yep.
So we might as well be raising our children in addition to our pastoral, you know.
That's duties. Fantastic. So. And I really think this bivocational idea for pastors is such a good idea. Because I think that's the other thing I would say that I grew up with was seeing a lot of guys. I mean, my dad was very much an exception to the rule. He's a hard worker. Mm-hmm. He probably worked more than 60, 70 hours a week regularly. Sure. And he was so accountable for like the money that came into our home through support raising and all of that. And he's been that way his whole life still. There's still supportive missionaries today. Mm. But I saw so many guys, especially here in Australia, who were just like, yeah, we ain't out for coffee. We're going to do this. You know, and it just was like, you're not actually working. And it's, you know, like Christian work should be work. And you kind of wonder almost if there's an element to which, like, there's a reason why Paul was tent making. Like he was a tent maker. He had an actual job. He wasn't just, you know, sailing around on boats and telling people about Jesus. He did something, and you can assume that his work informed his ministry.
Amen. I mean, the way that we have structured our churches would be completely antithetical to anything Paul understood as church.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I mean, these are house churches, you know, like it's just, it would be mind-boggling to him that like there is a guy on staff who gets paid to only do this ministry.
And that the money of the church is flowing toward buildings and church salaries as opposed to feeding and caring for the orphans, the widows, the community. It's just head exploding. I could talk about this for a long time. I'm sorry. I know this isn't why I'm totally here.
Even on top of that, and here's one of my soapboxes is you take somebody who has trained for years, done seminary, has graduate degrees in theology and Bible, and you put them over a church, but then you take a bunch of other guys usually who are just good at business for some reason and then make them his
executive pastor.
Like, what is that? What is that? Even the elder board. Like, why is an elder board making ministry decisions for somebody who is trained to do ministry?
It's very odd. And I think this is where I think, honestly, if you, I mean, in my very uneducated, just observer, reader, journalist perspective, I really think that that model, we're looking at the decline of that model in the United States. Because I think the reality is that in the rest of the world, in the parts of the world where persecution actually exists, like China and India and Iran and then Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, there's incredible stories coming out of these places. And the church doesn't look anything like that. The church there looks like people just getting the job done, needing to do their work anyway to provide for themselves.
Right.
And these are the people we should be looking to really lead us in how to do church in our Western context. But again, I have a lot of opinions about this.
And I totally agree with that.
A lot of opinion, but
I totally agree with that. I mean, you are correct. I mean, in our area, we're seeing very much that decline as well. And the single pastor model just is not working anymore.
Yeah.
And I do think bivocational pastors are that is the next step. That is what needs to happen.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. I love that. I love talking about that stuff. Okay. Let's get to the podcast. Cause I don't want to like, just, you know, I just don't want to like rush through that, I guess.
Yeah,
because of time. So can you just talk about the podcast and the why and some of that?
Sure. So, last year, Jessica van der Weingard and I met up for the first time. So Jess, she directed and she really made the film, I Survived, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. It's a film about Josh's process of reconsidering his beliefs around dating, and the beliefs that were sort of amplified in his book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. She didn't know, of course, that when it released a few months after that, Josh would be announcing that he and his wife were divorcing and that he was leaving the faith as he knew it. I don't actually, personally, I don't, when I read his Instagram, I think he's just being a bit clever about that. I don't really think he's left the faith. I think he's just left sort of fundamentalist evangelicalism. That's my opinion, only my opinion, based on what I've read on social media of his. So I met up with her. It just so happens that I know Jess from a long time ago. She was really good friends with both my sisters and she when she worked at the Apple store. And so we just caught up. Jess was trying to release this film and dealing with, you know, the aftermath of all of that. And we just started talking and I kind of just said, hey, maybe we should start a podcast together. Just out of it literally just came out of my mouth. It was like out of nowhere. I'd been thinking about starting a podcast for a long time. I didn't know about what, but it was something that I felt like I enjoy I thought I would enjoy the medium because it is very different from writing. So then we started talking about it. We talked about it for a long time. And then kind of because of the long process, we kind of started to come to this model of having a discussion around sexual ethics. So the podcast is called Where Do We Go From Here? Because I think for us, the whole beating up on purity culture thing, people were doing it and we do it some on the podcast, hopefully in an intelligent way and an empathetic way. But we really are more interested in what comes next. So that's the where do we go from here? Like, so, okay, right. Purity culture is gone. What's next? What are we going to do? And so we say that we're untangling sexual ethics for a new generation of Christians. And that's both metaphorical. I think a new generation of Christians for me is just people like you and I who are actively trying to live a real faith, live a historical Christian faith. But it's also for a new generation, like younger Christians as well, and for people who are in relationship with younger Christians. So pastors, parents, grandparents, who are seeking to kind of understand and how they could do better the second time around. So that's the show. We're up to today 45 episodes. So we've been doing it for about a year and it's been great, like really a wonderful conversation. I've been amazed at the ways people want to engage with this material and the stories we hear of people who are actually applying what they learned to their life. I think what I would say that the podcast does differently is, first of all, Jess and I come from differing perspectives and we try to have different perspectives on the show. So we don't just have conservatives. We don't just have progressives. We have people who would disagree with each other on this, on the topic of human sexuality if they were in the same room talking to each other. But so that's one thing that we try to do. I think the other thing we really try to do is we don't want to be prescriptive. We don't want to be the podcast you listen to know what to do about your sexual life. Right. We don't want to give people those direct answers, partly because that's what we see being a problem both in the Christian world, but also the secular world. Yeah. Because the truth is, I think we want adults, that's who we are, we're adults, to be able to take ownership and accountability and responsibility for their own life. And we think that that happens through deep engagement with questions and experts and stories. So that's kind of what we do on the show.
Yeah, I think that's important stuff. That's really good.
Yeah.
I'm glad y'all are tackling that stuff. And anytime, I mean, I got into this podcast game about work sort of thinking I had it figured out and I was going to sort of share stories so people could figure it out too.
Yes.
and have realized I had no idea what I was talking about and that there was so much more to it, you know? And I, anytime you explore a topic like that and ask questions and like really empathize and receive what other people have to say, I think it changes you.
It absolutely does. Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
Right. It's good. I love that. So, okay. I want to bring up sort of what you were talking about earlier, I guess, in your first church, you know, when you were very cynical about everybody else. It seems like in that church, and just from an outsider's perspective, that there was sort of what a lot of churches have, which is sort of an idolatry around the perfect human relationship, which is that marriage and children is sort of this apex of human life.
Yep.
And anything less than that is ungodly or at least not blessed by God, correct?
Yeah, well, it hit on every level. It wasn't just ungodly or potentially ungodly, or there was potential for ungodliness if you were a single in a way that was different. But it was also that you weren't a fully formed human being.
Right.
And yeah. that, I think, is what was so profoundly painful for the singles around us. And what I hear over and over from other people is that it's what's painful for singles in their lives and for singles themselves, is this idea that you can be 40, you can be 35, you can be 45, but somehow you will never be perfected or sanctified in a way that a married person is, because you're not married. And it's so unfair. You know, there are certain things, like, I think it would be unfair to tell somebody just get a better job. But if you tell somebody to get a better job, there's kind of a pathway to get there. There's no pathway to marriage. Like, there isn't, in that sense. Right. Like, maybe you can tell people, like, go on a dating app, or yeah, maybe just date more, whatever. But there's really the core thing about a marriage relationship is that it's two people who want to be together. You can't force somebody to want to be with you. And that is a pain and a wounding in a single person's life. I think it can be a wounding. I don't think it has to be, but it is when we say that marriage is the be all and end all of the Christian life. And so, yeah, it really was. And I think I really look back on that experience now and see that as just a group of really insecure people who looked at the culture around them and said, marriage is in danger. We need better marriages. And so we have some people here anyway who are struggling in their marriage. Let's give them these set of rules. And let's get them to follow these rules, because that's going to work. And it was very much, you know, The Excellent Wife by Martha Pierce, something like that. It's a very conservative stuff. Like, sorry, I shouldn't say very conservative. Very, because there's nothing wrong with conservative ideas. I think what I'm trying to say there is the ideas of, like, your husband is the head. You need to praise him no matter what. You need to give him sex no matter what. It doesn't matter. You know, you need to look beautiful for him. You need these kinds of ideas that are extraneous, extra biblical ideas. You give them biblical weighting, and you make women feel and men feel like they need to be a certain way to have this successful relationship. And it works for a little while. But I'll tell you what, in the 3 years after I left that church and moved to Switzerland, the number of marriages that failed, like divorced, actually, it was so beautiful when I was there. And then it kind of exploded. And it truly did not work. Like, I think that's kind of where I come down to it. I think where I've come to in marriage is that two people make it work, and you need to be on the same page about how it's going to work. And that's why there are complementarians who have great marriages and egalitarians who have great marriages. And that's why you have complementarians who end up in divorce and egalitarians who divorce, because it's ultimately just two people making their relationship work. And it's the people who really are able to do that and who are emotionally healthy and who are honest and committed to connection and vulnerability and doing the work and forgiveness. Those are the marriages that succeed. And there is no 5-step plan to that. Like, it just, well, you're married to a therapist. You know, you've heard.
I get all the repercussions from all of that, where it's like, okay, so we need to talk this, you know what I mean? Like, everything is just like, we do a lot of processing in my household, which is great, you know? Yeah. So would you say that sort of ideal, that I would call it idolatry, that we're talking about right there, is part and parcel of purity culture? I mean, would you describe that as part of that whole system that is put in place?
I absolutely would. So I think the purity culture that we think of is a movement geared towards teenagers. So it's True Love Waits, you know, it's the purity rings, the purity balls, all that stuff. But really, there was a follow-on after that. So when I was looking into this, it's interesting. Tim and Beverly LaHaye, they wrote a book. I want to say they published it 76, 78, something like that, called The Act of Marriage. And it's a very, it's kind of the first Christian sex book, if you will. It doesn't look like you've read it.
Nope.
It doesn't look like you've heard of it. Okay. Well, it's a big one. I mean, I still remember when I was in 2007, I was a bridesmaid in a friend's wedding, and she had The Act of Marriage. She was reading it with her fiance getting ready to get married. So that's 2007.
Gotcha.
Okay. So it's had a lasting impact. Yeah. And the notable thing about the Christian sex books for married people is that they always talk about a wife's pleasure and that being an important thing. So I will give them that. But I think they had all of the other garbage of like, wives, you need to look good for your husbands. You need to give your husband sex. You need to do this. You need to do all of this stuff that I think was really, really harmful to Christian marriages. So Sheila Grigor talks about this. She has a blog called To Love, Honor, and Vacuum. She's amazing. And she talks a lot about how the act of marriage actually actively harmed her marriage and other books like Intended for Pleasure, Sheet Music. These are some of the kind of Christian sex books, I guess.
We did read Sheet Music.
Yes. So that one's a little different. Yeah. I feel like that's probably a little bit on the better side. But I think there are ideas even in there that are a little bit, you know, skewed. And so I think this idea that Christian marriages need to be great, not just like mediocre. And I think this is a reaction to the culture and the divorce rate in the church and outside the church. So before the gay marriage question ever came on the scene, I think divorce was the cultural issue evangelicals in the US were battling. And it wasn't just about let's just have good, healthy marriages. We are good, healthy marriages are a testimony to the efficacy of the gospel. Right? So we have better marriages, better parents, better kids, better teenagers. We have them in the church. And you show your beautiful white middle class picket fence American life off to people, and then they want to become Christians. That was the kind of idea. And I think that's part of the reason why the idolatry so stuck is because it tied into American dream ideas. It tied into wealth ideas, prosperity, gospel ideas. And it tied into this idea that it was also an evangelistic tool. So that's a pretty, like, if you have all of those things grouped into one, that's a pretty, I mean, that's a big idol. It's going to be hard to topple that one. And then, you know, I think the divorce rate kind of starts toppling it.
Well, and I mean, and I guess maybe I'll form this as a question instead of a statement. But then does that lead us to be unwilling to have hard conversations about sex and sexuality during those decades, which leads us to where we are today?
Yeah, I think, look, the reality is sex and sexuality conversations are difficult. That's the reality. No one ever, there's never been a generation when across the board people have done this well. So I think it's difficult when there's shame and secrecy around it, when you have people who were being sexually abused in the background. So that was a reality for our parents and grandparents is there were people experiencing abuse of all kinds, maybe even more than we know about it today. And then, so I think, so your question is, can we do it? What was the question? Sorry.
Well, I guess I don't know that I actually asked the question. Okay. I said I was going to form it as a question and I didn't.
But okay.
I guess I see that there's been an unwillingness to address a lot of awkward issues in the church for the last, I don't even know how long. I don't have enough, like, I haven't been around long enough to know, but that has landed us in this position today where, like, we've just not talked about it for long enough that it, like, we don't haven't exercised those muscles or don't know how to talk about it.
Yeah. So I would say yes. So we have not talked about it in the past. We've not talked about it, and we have all this baggage. So we have all this baggage that we've not talked about collectively and individually. But I do think that there is a hunger now to talk about it. I think there has been a building hunger for years. So when I was in my last year of university, I wrote a story about premarital sex on our campus. So this was 2005. So a long time ago, long enough. And I remember the day that story came out, and it was a story about five individuals on our campus who had all signed community covenants to not have premarital sex. And it was their stories of having various kind of sexual experiences and premarital sex, from people who regretted it to people who did not. And I remember when that story came out, walking in our student center and looking down, every table had somebody sitting at it reading with the paper open to that page, and it was silent. People were just reading. Wow. And I realized then that we didn't realize that Christians actually had premarital sex. We might have suspected, but we'd never heard from them. And we had certainly never heard from them out of the in the context of I don't care. We had only heard of it from I really messed up my life by doing this. And Jesus, you know, Jesus is kind to me. Don't ever do it yourself. That was the context, you know. And so I think that was 2005. So I think there was a hunger then. But I think we have better tools now to have these conversations. I think we as a culture, secular, Christian, whatever, are more inclusive of therapy and the ideas from the psychological field around attachment, connection, how to have good conversations, empathy, and the way those tools have made our relationships oftentimes a lot better, all of our relationships. So I think there's an incredible opportunity for people today, doesn't matter how old you are, to be able to just have normal conversations about sexuality with people. And I think the more you normalize it exactly where you are, the way that you become the first domino to fall in that place, in that person's life. And then it then will spur that person, hopefully, to have that kind of conversation. And that's what we hope our podcast is in people's lives, is a tool to have those better conversations with people in their communities.
I love it. I think that's important work, Devi.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking that on. And yeah, can't wait to see what y'all have going. What's the best ways to sort of find you, follow you, all of those
Sure.
things?
Well, you can subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Where do we go from here? You can go to our website, wheredowegopod.com, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at wheredowegopod. And we love hearing from listeners. I think this is one thing I would say. Our podcast is very much a two-way street where what comes out of in the podcast is often informed by the conversations we have with our listeners. And so it's really such a necessary thing for people to talk back to us. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's important to have that conversation. And yeah, it's good stuff. Okay, well, are you ready to jump into the final two questions?
Yes.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Okay. Well, my very first paid job in Australia was Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and that was doing laundry at an aged care facility. It was not so fun. Wow. Yeah, it was very humbling. Very humbling. My aunts were nurses at an aged care facility, so that's how I got the job. But Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and it just so happened that I think Christmas Day was on a Sunday. So I got paid $25 an hour to do that job. So yeah,
that's legit.
That's why I did it.
That's legit. Awesome. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Do your job well. I think that's the best testimony to a Christian of a Christian is you do it well. You do it with integrity. You do it with humility. You do it to the best of your ability. You get retraining when you need to get better at it. You shield the people who work for you. I think, you know, one story, I mean, I can close with, it's a Tim Keller story that I heard. I mean, I heard it in 2008. So it's a long, long time ago. He said he had a guy in his church at Redeemer, I guess, who worked for a media company in New York. So a big media company. And somebody worked for him and she really messed up something and he took the fall for it, like just took the fall, totally protected or whatever. And she came in and was like, why did you do that? And he goes, whatever, it's no big deal. I did it. It's no problem. She's like, no, why did you do it? She pushed him until finally he said, look, this is what Jesus did for me on the cross. He took the fall for me. So I took the fall for you. And she showed up at Redeemer the next Sunday. And I think we don't think enough about the witness of how we work, the way it can actually communicate to people the actual truth of the gospel. Are you giving people second chances? Are you forgiving people at your work? But also, are you doing a good job? Are you good at what you do? We don't think enough about those things, I think.
Yeah. I think you're totally right about that. And that's much appreciated. That's good stuff. Devi, it was so good to talk. And yeah, this has been great.
Thank you for having me, Kari. This is, I love this conversation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Devi and just talking about this, you know, sort of purity culture, idolatry, just the culture of the church and how we as a church sort of present ourselves to the world. I think all these things are really important. So do go check out Devi's podcast. There's a lot of good stuff over there. Make sure you're following her on Instagram so you can kind of read the things that she's been writing and just, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff here. If this made you sort of reorient your thinking, I'd love to hear about it. I'd love to keep this conversation going. I think it's really important stuff and stuff we need to be talking about. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can rate and review the podcast there. That just helps get the word out about the podcast. Just lets people know that somebody's listening to it. So I greatly appreciate you doing all that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.